Welcome to Super Sound Off, episode 258 here on SEScoops.com. It is Super Bowl Sunday, February 3rd, 2013. I am the Solemn Monster. Hope everybody's having a good weekend. As I record this, the big game, only a couple of hours away here in the U.S., it is Super Bowl 40-something or other. I forgot which number it is. But obviously, all eyeballs will be on that game tonight. For the record, my prediction is San Francisco over Baltimore. We'll say 28-20. That's my prediction. One of our listeners, Cliff, actually wrote in with his own thoughts on the big game. He thinks the Harbaugh brothers rivalry is taking attention away from the guys actually playing in the Super Bowl, and he says that it reminds me of the amount of attention the McMahons got when each of them was in a wrestler's corner during the Fatal 4-Way at WrestleMania 2000. Maybe Jim Harbaugh will smack Colin Kaepernick in the head with a steel chair late in the fourth quarter as Kaepernick is about to throw the game-winning touchdown to cost the 49ers the game. Then the Harbaugh brothers and Ray Lewis will all hug in the middle of the field. Well, you know what? That could happen. That could happen. I guess the only question is who's the female that Kaepernick's going to come back in and give the people's elbow to? If you want to really recreate the WrestleMania 16 main event, you got to go all the way with it. So anyway, that was Cliff. We got a lot to get to this week. We're not going to waste any more time. Royal Rumble, Raw, Impact, and some big TNA news as well. Bret Hart was in the news this week. Undertaker is being talked about quite a bit for a guy who hasn't been on television in many months. So we're going to get to all that. First, we'll start with the Royal Rumble last weekend. A little bit of a Rumble postmortem here. The WWE Championship match, CM Punk and The Rock. Of course, The Rock is 8-time WWE champion, to the surprise, I think, of very few people. Rock won the title, I thought, in a pretty good match. I enjoyed that match very much. In fact, I enjoyed this pay-per-view. You know, not everything was great, but I think there was enough really good stuff on that show. This is one of the better Rumble pay-per-views, I think, in a number of years. I certainly enjoyed this show a hell of a lot better than I did the 2012 show. Rock and Punk, real good match. I actually enjoyed Rock vs. Punk, I think, more than Rock vs. Cena. Rock vs. Cena was a much bigger match in terms of the aura, you know, big-time WrestleMania main event. But as a match, I think Rock vs. Punk was probably better than Rock vs. Cena Part 1 from last year's WrestleMania. I thought the false finish in the match was great. I thought that was great stuff. The crowd shots of people all dejected and stunned with their hands on top of their heads. I thought it was really, really cool. Very well done. Vince McMahon coming out, teasing that he's going to strip him of the championship. And then Rock, of course, being the hero, doesn't want that to happen. He wants the match to be restarted. Vince says okay. They wrestle for about another 2 minutes. The one thing about the match that I did not like, and actually there was a spot in the match where that was supposed to be the big spot of the match, the Rock bottom through the Spanish announce table. Unfortunately, the table collapsed under their weight, primarily the weight of the Rock, because let's be honest, I don't think that table is going to collapse with all 200 pounds of CM Punk on top of it. I called it, by the way. I was with a couple of people watching this pay-per-view, and as they were getting on top of the table, I kept saying, God, that table's going to break, that table's going to break. And I had flashbacks to Triple H trying to pedigree Kurt Angle through the table at SummerSlam 2000 when that broke. And thankfully, Rock did not get knocked loopy the way Kurt Angle did in that match. They recovered, I thought, quite well. Rock gave him the Rock Bottom on the floor instead. The one thing about the match I did not like and I thought was really, really weak was the finish with Rock winning with the people's elbow. I thought for sure this match was ending with a Rock Bottom. You know, Rock had teased that on Raw last week. He said, listen, you know, I'm going to have you high above my head, and time is going to stand still for you, and, you know, you're going to realize that your time is up. I thought that was telegraphing the finish of the match. I think the Rock Bottom would have been a much better way to finish off Punk. I thought, you know, ending with a people's elbow is weak no matter what, but when the match restarted, it was all Punk. You know, Punk was kicking Rock. He was just kicking the shit out of him, and he, you know, hit the elbow off the top. Rock kicked out. He went for the go to sleep. All Rock did was just shove Punk off, you know, shove Punk into the ropes and give him a spine buster. And, you know, he follows it up with a people's elbow. It's not even as though he wore Punk down. He set Punk up with a Rock Bottom first. See, if you would have Rock Bottom Punk and then given him the people's elbow, no problem. I would have no problem with that. I thought that was really, really weak. I did not like using the people's elbow as a finish. I just thought, you know, 434 days as the WWE champion, all the people that Punk beat, from Del Rio to Miz to Ziggler to Bryan to Kane to Big Show, Cena a million times, Ryback, albeit with interference, but champion for 14 months, all the people he's beaten, and a people's elbow beat CM Punk. I just thought that was really, really dumb. But that aside, I enjoyed the match. And according to Brian Bird on our Facebook page, who I know many of you are quite fond of, Sound Off 191 is the episode where CM Punk won the WWE Championship. I presume by that he means that was the first Sound Off after Punk won the title at Survivor Series in 2011. That was episode 191. And it was episode 257 last week that was the last Sound Off, I guess, with CM Punk as champion. That's 66 episodes of this show CM Punk was WWE champion for. So there's some useless trivia for you. Speaking of CM Punk, there was a lot of people very upset that Rock won the title. Brian Blade, for example, was just beside himself with anger, ready just to sell off his WrestleMania ticket when the show was over. It was quite amusing. But perhaps there was no bigger fan of CM Punk's who was upset about this outcome than the 70-year-old liquor store employee. I'm sure all of you have heard the story by now. This guy worked at a liquor store, which got robbed. He was shot in the eye. Somehow he survived, although it looks like he's going to lose vision in that eye. And they interviewed him on the news, and he said, you know, the worst thing about his week wasn't getting shot in the face. The worst part of his week was learning that CM Punk lost the WWE title to The Rock. And that's a fan right there. That is a dedicated, loyal fan. Punk actually appeared on a radio show a couple days ago with this other guy. They weren't in the studio together, but they got Punk on the line, and Punk was basically just heaping praise on this guy, and he's going to try to get him to come out to a show when they come to, I guess, Albany or wherever this guy lives. So that was kind of interesting. You get shot in the face, and the worst part of your week is Rock winning the title. I think you need to... I think you need to take things a little less seriously. I know there's a lot of Rock haters out there. People just absolutely loathe the fact that this guy is champion. I love it. I think it's great that you've got this bona fide A-list Hollywood celebrity, this big-time movie star, who, by the way, has four different movies coming out in the next 4 months. He's got this Snitch movie, which looks pretty good, coming out this month. Next month, I think, is the G.I. Joe Retaliation movie that was originally supposed to come out last summer and got pushed back. That's coming out in March. April is Pain and Gain, which is that movie with him and Mark Wahlberg, which actually looks pretty entertaining. And May, I think, is Fast and the Furious 6, which I'm looking forward to. I may end up seeing all of them. So, anyway, the point is, Rock's already out there. He's got the title belt he's posing with. You know, not that he's going to bring it to every interview he does, but this gets the company a lot of really good publicity that they would not otherwise be getting, especially as we get closer to WrestleMania and Rock does the talk show circuit. Maybe he'll bring the belt with him on, you know, Jimmy Fallon or Jay Leno, or even if he doesn't. Just having him as champion is a big boost for the company. And I think it's great. I enjoyed the match. As far as the Royal Rumble match itself, well, what can I say? When Dolph Ziggler got bro-kicked by Sheamus out to the floor, I let out a loud expletive, I will admit. I was not happy about that. And of all people, really, Sheamus, who has delivered how many bro kicks over the last year to Dolph Ziggler? I can't even count anymore. I guess in that way, it's apropos. If it had to be somebody, it was Sheamus who eliminated Ziggler and did it with a bro kick. Ziggler was the Iron Man in this Rumble, only by about a minute or so. It was really him and Chris Jericho who made his return. Jericho went about 47 or 48 minutes. Ziggler went 49 and change. The actual Rumble went about 55 minutes, so one of the longer Rumbles they've done in recent years. They had the 90-second intervals. You know, Ziggler not only didn't win the Rumble, which I predicted he would, I actually changed my prediction last week from John Cena, who did win the Rumble, to Dolph Ziggler, and unfortunately I was wrong. I should have kept my original pick. But not only did Ziggler not win the Rumble, he took the pin in his tag team match with Jericho against Hell No on Raw Monday night, and he tapped out to Del Rio's cross arm breaker on SmackDown. So the only thing I could think of here is he's got to be winning the title soon. He just has to be. I mean, this is, he just keeps losing. It's like he's allergic to winning, And usually that's a sign that perhaps somebody's about to win the championship. I guess we'll see. Maybe he does it at Elimination Chamber. He seems to be the odd man out right now on SmackDown this week. They had Booker T announce the SmackDown Elimination Chamber match at the pay-per-view is not going to be for the World Heavyweight title. Booker T announced that the winner would get a shot at the champion, I presume at WrestleMania, although I don't think they actually specified that. It's going to include all former World Heavyweight Champions. It's looking like Kane, Daniel Bryan, The Great Khali, Randy Orton, Sheamus, and the returning Jack Swagger. Swagger returned to TV on Friday night. He beat Kofi Kingston with an ankle lock in a match where he was supposed to impress Booker T to earn himself a spot in the chamber. So I assume because he won and did so in impressive fashion that he'll be in there. Anyway, you know, and that's a good thing, too, because that's a high-profile spot. Jack Swagger just came back. He was a glorified jobber the last time we saw him on TV. Remember the whole thing with Swagger? He had won, like, one match on Raw in the course of a year, and it looks like he may be in the running for a World Heavyweight title match at the pay-per-view in the chamber. So, you know, good for him. But to me, you know, Khali is just such a waste of a spot. He's just a spot filler. That's really all Khali is at this point. You know, Mark Henry should be ready to return right about now. I know there's been some debate about whether or not he even is going to return. If, you know, I don't know what the condition of his shoulder is. If he feels he can't come back, he might just retire, but he should be fully recovered from surgery now. And to me, that would be the perfect spot for Mark Henry to come back in. Whether he, you know, he's on SmackDown next week and makes a surprise return. I mean, obviously, if he's going to be in the chamber, he'll have to return on SmackDown at some point in the next 2 weeks or so. You know, wouldn't that be a much better choice? I mean, same goes for Christian. I know Christian also is healing up from some injuries. I don't know if he's ready or not. If he is, why not Christian? I mean, to me, it's anybody but Khali. You've got other options. If you want former world champions, you have at least two other high-profile former champs that you can go for, you know, for a spot in this match. I don't know why they keep going back to Khali. He's nothing. He's just completely useless at this point. But anyway, that's the story on the Elimination Chamber match for SmackDown. Back to the Rumble match last Sunday, real quick. Surprises were Chris Jericho, Goldust, and The Godfather. So all the rumors that were flying around about Carlito and Chris Masters and Shelton Benjamin and whoever else was all bullshit. And I don't even think I ever really... I may have briefly mentioned it at some point. I don't think I ever even really mentioned it here on the show. Apparently some of them were in town where the Rumble was taking place in Phoenix, but it was for an independent show. So... Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that doesn't mean that Benjamin and Carlito aren't in the under consideration for coming back. There have been rumors that WWE is looking to bring back some old mid-card guys to help put over some of the newer, younger talent. So perhaps, you know, Benjamin I could see ending up in WWE only because he specifically asked out of his Ring of Honor contract so that he could negotiate with WWE. Carlito, I'm less sure about. Masters, I don't know. But Benjamin, I think, could still show up at some point on TV. Rumble match itself, I liked it. Not my favorite Rumble of all time, but again, I enjoyed it better than a lot of the Rumbles over the last couple of years, to be honest with you. I thought it was a very well-booked match. I thought there were some really fun spots. The spot with Goldust, you know, wrestling with his brother Cody, I thought was really good. And, I mean, what else happened during this match? I mean, there were you know, just a lot of good action, a couple of good surprises. It went a decent amount of time. They had some pretty innovative stuff, too. Kofi Kingston, of course, being knocked off the apron, landing on Tenzai's back, and then he's kind of stranded on a desert island in a way on top of the announce desk, doesn't know how to get back into the ring, and does the spot where he takes JBL's chair and he kind of uses it like a pogo stick and basically bounces his way back into the ring. I thought that was really cool. I guess Kofi will be doing the innovative spot each year in the Rumble, so his job should be safe if for that reason, if nothing else. They got to keep him around for the Rumble each year. Just, you know, again, a fun Rumble. I enjoyed it. I saw some hate for it. I don't really understand why. Probably most of that centered around the fact that John Cena won. I can understand that. I also was kind of, what's the right word? You know, nonplussed, perhaps, would be the best word to use. You know, John Cena wins the Rumble. You know, hooray. Who cares? Like I said, you could have easily put him in that WrestleMania main event spot without having to put him over in the Rumble. I don't really know what good that does, but in any event, there you go. We had Del Rio beat Big Show in the Last Man Standing match. Also a good match. The duct tape finish was... I mean, the duct tape finish was what it was. I mean, really, if you were in Alberto Del Rio's shoes, let's be realistic about this. If you were Del Rio and you were up against a guy the size of the Big Show, right, and you're having difficulty with him, and there are no rules in this match. It's last man standing, so technically that means it's no DQ. You can do whatever you want. Well, if you tape the guy's feet to the bottom rope, he ain't going to be able to move. He's not going to be able to get on his feet. And the whole object of a last man standing match is to make sure the guy doesn't answer to the 10 count. So, you know, in that respect, I have no problem with it. In fact, if I were Del Rio, I'd probably be looking to do something similar. Anything to win. And that's what he did. So I didn't really have a problem with the finish like other people did. I mean, somewhere perhaps in his living room, Batista was watching this and, you know, shouting at the television, "Duct tape, are you kidding me?" Because Batista had a little experience with duct tape before with John Cena, but I thought that was fine. Road Scholars, losers, losing to Team Hell No. This one surprised me. I really thought this was the time for Sandow and Rhodes to take the titles, and I suppose the reason why that didn't happen, if anybody watched SmackDown this week, you saw the unfortunate backstage segment with Damian Sandow and Cody Rhodes announcing that they have broken up. Team Road Scholars is no more. And they went over to Booker T and Teddy Long backstage, and they did something that was kind of unique. Normally when a team breaks up, it's because there's dissension in the ranks or one guy turns on the other. I like this in that that's not what we had here. We had two guys go to the GM and basically say, "Listen, we want to get back to pursuing our singles careers. So we're going to break up as a team, but we're still going to be the best of friends." And then they hugged. And you know what? In TNA, eventually when Christopher Daniels and Kazarian break up, and let's pray that that doesn't happen for many more years to come, but eventually most teams do break up. And when Kazarian and Daniels break up, I hope they break up the exact same way. They just come out and say, "Listen, we're ready to pursue our singles careers," which they actually kind of already did that. They kind of already did on Impact many weeks ago. I think, if I remember correctly, they did a promo where they basically announced they were going to pursue their singles careers more, although they're pretty much still a full-time tag team. But eventually, when they do break up, I hope it's a situation where they can still be the best of friends. Because to me, the fact that when you break up, you got to turn on the other guy, or you know, you start seeing it where they're having matches, and one guy accidentally bumps into the other guy, and it's the same shit over and over and over again. It's nice to know that every now and then guys can break up, not because they hate each other, but because they're just ready to go their separate ways, and they still want to be friends. So I'm cool with that, although it still makes me very sad they never had a run with the belts. I think that could have been very entertaining. And also, I think it's a huge blow to the tag team division in WWE. A tag team division that only a couple of months ago was flourishing in some ways, although I still feel like they need one or two more solid teams. And now they need a lot more than that, because you've got a situation where Tyson Kidd is hurt, so his team with Justin Gabriel is no more. It's on hold for now, if not done forever. Now the Road Scholars are broken up. You've got the Usos, I guess, are left, the primetime players, and you've got Kane and Bryan, who, quite frankly, as entertaining as I still find them to be most of the time, you know, at some point in the very near future, they're going to have to break that team up also, because it just gets played out after a while, and those guys, and particularly Daniel Bryan, just has to move on to something else. So who are you left with? What other teams are there, really, besides the primetime players and the Usos? I mean, am I missing something here? I might be missing a team I'm not thinking of, but there really aren't very many other teams. So all of a sudden, the momentum that the tag team division seemed to have has kind of hit a brick wall, unfortunately, and hopefully they can do something about that. But anyway, that was the Rumble pay-per-view. There was also a pre-show match with Cesaro and Miz, and thankfully Cesaro did beat The Miz. He is still the United States champion. Overall, I enjoyed the Royal Rumble. I thought it was worth the money that I paid for it. We had fun. I watched it with a group of friends. We all enjoyed it. And it felt like a big-time event, especially with Rock winning at the end. And doing so in a way where it still keeps Punk in the mix. You know, happy to see on Raw this week that it's not as though they're kind of shoving CM Punk to the side. I mean, that may happen at some point when we get closer to WrestleMania. And we'll talk about the situation that Punk kind of finds himself in. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But Punk's still very much in the mix, arguing that he beat The Rock at the Rumble, which he did. He got a visual pinfall on the Rock when they did that false finish where the Shield ran in, the lights went out, they triple bombed Rock through the announce table. That's what Michael Cole called it, by the way, not a triple team powerbomb. He called it a triple bomb. I don't know if that's the official name of the move now or if Michael Cole just fucked up. But again, clever little thing they did in that match, and gives Punk a reason to be rightfully upset, you know, being the champion as long as he had, and, you know, he got the pin on the Rock, and still in the end, he got screwed. So, Raw Monday Night was from Las Vegas, Nevada. Some noteworthy things on this show. CM Punk stuff I thought was great. From the moment Punk walked out, just an absolute madman at the beginning of the show, going crazy, beside himself with anger over what happened the night before, talking about how it was the Phoenix screw job. He got screwed worse than Bret Hart did in Montreal. I thought Punk was great. I thought Rock was great, you know, when he came out and did his thing, and the back and forth with him and Punk I thought was stellar. Especially, you know, Rock calling him a punk-ass bitch and then Punk kind of throwing it back in his face and saying, oh, you know, I guess we have to be cool. Swearing is cool, punk-ass bitch. And just really good stuff. That set up the rematch for the Elimination Chamber, so the title will not be on the line in a chamber match, which is good. I would rather see Rock versus Punk in a singles match again. I would imagine there'll be some sort of stipulation, maybe no DQ or something attached to that. But again, Punk was great, Rock was great. Paul Heyman on Raw Monday Night was out of this world. I thought, just out of this world, phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal, Paul Heyman. Paul Heyman's been great in this role since day one. But that segment at the end of the show with Vince McMahon where Paul is just pleading his case and talking about how, you know, he's learning to be a better person. He could learn from Vince McMahon, which is such a pile of shit. It's not even funny. But it was supposed to be that way, you know, as though Vince McMahon is an honorable man, which, of course, in the past he hasn't been. What wrestling promoter is, and that goes for Heyman as well. But for whatever reason, the one line that really got me in Heyman's promo, at one point as he's just struggling to try to explain to Vince why he should stay and why Vince should not fire him, which is a huge logic hole as it is, because as I asked a week ago when I first tweeted this, how can Vince McMahon give Paul Heyman a performance evaluation with his job on the line when Heyman technically doesn't even work for him? You know, I guess they mentioned that at some point he signed a contract. When that happened, I don't know. You know, in storyline, I never heard that Paul Heyman signed a WWE contract. I mean, from the moment Paul Heyman came back, he was Brock Lesnar's legal representative. Then he became CM Punk's manager. Why Vince McMahon has power over him, I have no idea. But the line that Heyman threw out there at one point, he just said something to the effect of, like, I want to be here. Like, I want to be here. And I'm willing to do, you know, whatever it takes. Just the way he delivered that line, I don't know why. I just thought it was great. Basically, the gist of it was Vince McMahon said he had video footage to prove that Paul Heyman was in cahoots with, and perhaps Punk as well, in cahoots with The Shield. And the video showed Raw from about a week or two ago, which was the last time, by the way, we saw Brad Maddox on television. He's been very conspicuous by his absence since that time. Reason being, as we saw with this backstage footage, Paul Heyman took Brad Maddox to the recesses of the arena, I guess. The Shield kind of came out from the shadows. And Paul Heyman told him, look, take your beating like a man. It was like something out of a Sopranos episode or something. I thought this was very well done. Maddox is like, look, I'll go away. I'll leave you alone. Just please, let's not do this. And Heyman's like, listen, just take your beating like a man. And then the Shield all converged on him. They beat the shit out of Brad Maddox. Roman Reigns knocked the camera out, so we couldn't see what happened after that. But that proves unequivocally that Heyman, at least, was in cahoots with the Shield. And Heyman denies it. Heyman says, that wasn't me. Vince McMahon is like, well, was that the Shield? And Paul Heyman says, yes. And he goes, was that Brad Maddox? And he goes, yes. He goes, was that you? And he goes, no, that wasn't me. That was a Paul Heyman impersonator. And he had a line that was also great. He said something basically like, it's not me in that video. It's somebody, you know, impersonating me. They're doing like a Jewish voice. You know, for God's sakes, I'm a Jew. I forgot what he said. It was just hilarious. I really, really liked the end of the show. Brock Lesnar made his big comeback. I think a lot of people kind of could see that coming. This was just a very convenient storyline way to bring Brock Lesnar back into the mix. The last time we saw Brock was in the summer, and he quit. So if they're setting up a Brock Lesnar-Triple H rematch for WrestleMania, then why the hell would Brock Lesnar come back? Well, Paul Heyman's in trouble. Brock comes to his rescue. Makes sense. And Lesnar comes into the ring. He confronts Vince McMahon. Again, Paul Heyman was great. He's begging Brock to not do anything. And when he realizes that he can't control Brock and Brock's going to do whatever he wants to do, you can hear Heyman in the background screaming at Vince, please leave the ring. He's saying, Vince, please leave the ring, because he knows something bad's about to happen. And indeed it did. Brock Lesnar delivered an F5 to Vince McMahon, which was a hell of a bump for a 67-year-old man with a bad hip to take. Apparently Vince is having surgery on his hip. I don't know which one, left or right. Sometime in the very near future, he's had hip troubles, I guess, and hip pain for a while, which, you know, if that's the case, not very bright to be taking a bump like that. He landed right on his left hip, so I would hope maybe it's his right one that's actually being operated on. That was a really dangerous bump for him to take. Very impressive. You know, I give him credit for taking it. Like I said, I don't know how smart that was. And the big story with Brock this week, he has signed a new deal. Brock Lesnar, for all you Lesnar haters out there, you better get used to him, because he's not going anywhere. He is locked in for a new 2-year deal with WWE that will take him and the company through WrestleMania 31 in the year 2015. I don't know what the details of the deal are. Realistically, I don't think anybody really does. It sounds like it's a very similar deal to the first one. He only is obligated for about 3, maybe 4 pay-per-view dates for the year. Very similar to the first deal he signed. So even the Brock Lesnar haters, let's be realistic. How often is he going to be on television? It's not like he's going to be on TV every week. So I, for one, am happy that Brock is staying with WWE. And not all that surprised either, because it wasn't like he was going to go back to fighting. I think he pretty much realizes those days are done. And what else is Brock going to do? Where else can he work where he can get a sweet deal to make all this money and work like 10 dates a year? You're not going to find that anywhere else. So Brock is back, and I guess him taking out Vince McMahon is an easy way to set up Triple H coming out, maybe as early as Raw this week, and doing an early kickoff for that rematch between the two of them for WrestleMania on April 7th. Just some other stuff from Raw Monday night also. For all the good stuff with Punk and Rock and Heyman and Lesnar, there was also a lot of bad shit on this show, and I want to single out John Cena's promo again. I feel like a broken record here, but John Cena had a match. Fresh off his Royal Rumble victory, he beat Cody Rhodes in like 30 seconds, which actually probably doesn't bode very well for Cody's career if he is breaking up the team with Sandow and he wants to pursue singles matches. If Monday night was any indication, he might want to rethink that. I mean, Cena just beat him like he was nobody. And I thought Cody Rhodes, actually, for the record, had a pretty good night at the Rumble, even though he and Sandow lost. He wrestled twice in one night. He had the spot, you know, the stuff with his brother. He actually eliminated Goldust from the Royal Rumble. I think he eliminated... I know he eliminated Kofi. He may have eliminated a few other people as well. He was in there for a while. I thought, you know, Cody's night at the Rumble, in the Rumble match, was pretty memorable. I thought he was one of the stars of the Rumble match. And, again, gets beaten 30 seconds like nobody on Raw Monday night, which is interesting because I remember asking John Cena at the WrestleMania pre-show press conference in Miami last year. I got to ask Cena a question. And I think I asked him about working with any guys, any younger guys that he hasn't yet had the chance to work with, anybody that he's excited about. Are there one or two people that stand out to him? And the one name that he mentioned was Cody Rhodes. And I really got the impression from talking to him then, and also we got to interview him at Access, which you can hear part of that interview on SoundOff 212. But just listening to him, I really got the impression that Cody was one of his, you know, quote, favorites. Cody was somebody who impressed him, who he really thought had a bright future, and maybe he does. Maybe he does feel that way. You would certainly never be able to tell based on how handily he beat him on Monday night. And then Cena cut a promo to announce which championship he was going to compete for at WrestleMania, as though there was really any debate which belt he would pick. But the thing about this promo, and I don't know whose fault this was. I don't know if this was Cena's fault. I don't know if this was, you know, the company's fault. But Cena basically announced the Rock versus Punk rematch at Elimination Chamber before the match was even announced. I mean, Rock and Punk didn't come out until later on in the show and formally announced that there would be a rematch for the championship between the two of them at the pay-per-view. And Cena's doing this promo when he's talking about, well, I'm either going to face Rock or I'm either going to face Punk if I, you know, want to compete for that championship. And some of the other things he said, he basically announced it before they actually could have a chance to announce it later in the show, which was very bizarre to me. And I find it hard to believe that Cena would fuck up that way. So I don't know if that was his fault or not, but that was very weird that he kind of spoiled the announcement about half an hour or an hour before it was actually announced. But I thought this was an absolutely horrendous promo. I thought he was fucking terrible on this show. And this is the second time in as many weeks, or in recent weeks, that Cena has cut an absolutely god-awful, horrendous promo on the show. In fact, it was the second time in 2 weeks, because it was the go-home show last week when he cut that rambling, seemingly drug-induced promo that just didn't make any sense, and if anything, probably cost some buys for the pay-per-view. You know, here he comes out, and one of the things that absolutely infuriated me about this was he completely buried Alberto Del Rio in the World Heavyweight title. Because in the course of this promo, he's kind of weighing the options, and he's saying, well, I could go for the world title, and I'd have a much better chance of winning that belt, or I can compete for the WWE Championship. The problem being, I don't have a chance against either one of these guys. And I'm listening to this and I'm going, first of all, you just completely buried the world title. Even if everybody realizes that it is an inferior belt, why are you going out there and burying Del Rio like that? It just doesn't make any sense. Oh, I can win that title easy. I think everybody realizes that. If I really want that belt, I'll just pick that belt. But I can't beat Rock and I can't beat Punk. What do you mean you can't beat Punk? I mean, yes, it's true that Punk has a lot of victories over Cena. He beat Cena back at, remember Money in the Bank in 2011, right? Great match between Punk and Cena. That's when Punk won the belt. They had a rematch at SummerSlam. The only reason Punk won the rematch at SummerSlam was because Triple H, as the referee, didn't see Cena's foot under the bottom rope. So it was a screw job finish in a lot of ways, as many of their matches have been. I mean, I guess they had that Night of Champions match. Was it like a time limit draw? It was a draw of some kind. It's not as though Punk has cleanly, soundly defeated John Cena on multiple occasions. And it's not like John Cena has never beaten CM Punk. He's beaten CM Punk plenty of times. In fact, I remember when he beat CM Punk on Raw in a tag match. I don't remember who the other participants were. But it just, why is he going out there saying that? It just, I don't know. And the match with Rock, you know, they had one match. Cena was pretty dominant in that match, especially at the end. And really, he only lost the match because he made a mistake and he got a little too cocky. Went to do the people's elbow, Rock nipped up, Rock bottom, 1-2-3. Even Michael Cole. Think back to WrestleMania 28. I was there live, so I didn't hear the announcing. I had to go back and watch it on TV. And I hear Michael Cole when the match is over and Rock has won. And people are celebrating. To hear him say, it was something to the effect of, it's like the last team to have the ball won the game tonight or something like that. Like, there really was no loser in this match. Rock just won by the skin of his teeth. And if that's the case, then why is John Cena out here talking about, like, oh, I can never beat either one of these guys, so I really have to think long and hard about which title I want to pick. I hated this fucking promo. It was terrible. Absolutely terrible. I don't know what's wrong with him lately. Because he can do pretty good stuff. He can go out there and cut a good promo when he wants to. The last 2 weeks, not good. Not good at all. So I didn't like that segment on Raw. In fact, it just pissed me off. You know, the stuff with Tenzai going out there dressed up in lingerie. Look, I don't need to see Tenzai wearing lingerie. I really don't. I don't even want to see Tenzai without a shirt off, quite frankly. But, as I said during the discussion on Monday night on Twitter, I said, listen, I saw Tenzai sing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer at Madison Square Garden back in December, and it was actually entertaining. I am in favor of Tenzai being used as a comedy babyface. I was hoping that's where they would go with this. And it looks like they are. It looks like there's some sort of alliance now with him and Brodus Clay. And I know that that is probably the mark of death for the guy. But I'm entertained by it. I wasn't entertained necessarily by this segment. When he started dancing, it got a little bit better. This segment overall was a complete waste of time. Don't get me wrong. This whole gimmick of Raw Roulette was completely unnecessary. It was a complete waste of time. I thought it was just completely stupid, as most of this show was. This show was completely carried by Rock, Punk, Heyman, Lesnar, and Vince. That's it. Everything else on this show sucked. But I am not as opposed to this whole Tenzai dancing and doing comedy shit as a lot of other people are, because you tell me, what better role right now is there for Tenzai? They tried to make him into a monster. It didn't work. It didn't work, I think, because they just went about it the wrong way. This guy shouldn't be out there pretending to be some Japanese samurai warrior. They never really gave him a chance to speak. Now they finally are giving him a chance to speak and show some personality, and I think that's a big part of why I find him so entertaining. So you can't all of a sudden try to make him into a monster. They tried that. It failed. The Japanese shit failed. Why he still goes out there with the Japanese, like, Hakushi tattoos all over his head and face, I don't know. They got to get rid of that. Just like Samoa Joe got rid of the big knife that he had tattooed on his face. That didn't work either. So you tell me, for the time being, what better role would you book for Tenzai? At least here, he'll get over. People are going to start to get into it. And eventually, if you want to try again, either as a heel or a face, but try to really build him up as something, even like a solid mid-card guy. You can do that 6 months down the road, a year down the road. But for now, this is fine. This is the right role for him. What else happened on this show? Really, not much else happened. I got to tell you, we're going to move on here because the rest of the show is just a complete colossal waste of time. And all signs for this week aren't that much better. They've already announced a Miz TV segment. Although, I take that back. Miz TV with Paul Heyman. If anybody can save Miz TV, it's Paul Heyman. So actually, for the first time, I am looking forward to a Miz TV segment. So that's what we have to look forward to this week. I think Lesnar is supposed to be on the show again this week. Rock is not, I don't think. And Triple H, who knows? Maybe he'll make an appearance. We'll find out. Now, speaking of WrestleMania, Undertaker has been the subject of a lot of debate this week. Undertaker's name has been in the news. A lot of reports floating around that Undertaker is in such horrendous shape physically, he may not be able to wrestle at WrestleMania this year, even though he already went to WWE, supposedly, and told them that he would wrestle. He had a hand-picked opponent, which many people believe is CM Punk. Now there's some debate about whether or not they're actually going to let him wrestle, whether or not he now feels he can physically do it. Undertaker is really, he's really broken down at this stage of the game. He's in his late 40s. He's got two bad hips. He's got bad knees. He's got one really bad shoulder. I don't know if it's the right one or the left one, but apparently it's so bad he can't even lift his arm above his head. I remember reading a report. I forgot if it was ligaments. I believe the report was something like ligaments in the shoulder. He's only got one natural ligament left. The rest of it is from other surgeries, and they're fake or replacements or whatever. Guy's in bad shape. I don't know what he looks like in person. I don't know if he walks around town hunched over like an old man or not. I don't know. You know, I know he's happily married with Michelle McCool. They had a kid recently. He's got a couple of kids, actually. But he's got a newborn. He's been off for many months. You would think and hope, with all the time off that he has, he can heal up enough to have one match. And the fact that even that one match is in doubt because of his physical condition, to me, I don't think he has anything left to prove. You know, last year at WrestleMania, despite what Bret Hart may think, that wasn't a bad match for him to go out on. If that match with Triple H, Hell in a Cell, turns out to be it, if that really does turn out to be Undertaker's swan song, and to be able to retire with an even 20-0 record at WrestleMania, that's a nice round number that'll sound just as fine when he goes into the Hall of Fame as 21-0 would or 22-0. And if he's in as rough shape as everyone seems to believe he is, I don't think it's worth the risk. I would almost rather Undertaker just call it quits and not wrestle at WrestleMania if he really is that bad. Selfishly, I'd love to see him at WrestleMania. One of the highlights of WrestleMania last year for me was just Undertaker's entrance. When the lights go out, we have the sky above, the smoke, the music. It's something special to be there live for an Undertaker entrance at WrestleMania. So I'm going to WrestleMania this year. I'd love for Undertaker to be there. But at what cost? You know, is he going to hobble his way down to the ring? Is he going to have a horrible, shitty match? And then that's going to be our last memory of him at WrestleMania? So that's my personal thought on The Undertaker. The bigger question is, where does this leave CM Punk? Because CM Punk now, I don't believe CM Punk is winning the title back from Rock. He could. He could win the championship back from him at the Elimination Chamber. And then Rock can, you know, get his rematch at WrestleMania as part of the match with Cena. They could do a triple threat. I have made no bones about the fact before that I am not a fan of multiple man matches for a WrestleMania main event. Cliff, who wrote in earlier, but with his little Super Bowl prediction, okay, he mentioned WrestleMania 2000, a McMahon in every corner. That was a fatal four-way. Rock, Triple H, Mick Foley, Big Show. Not a bad match, but not a WrestleMania main event. It's just like any other pay-per-view. You stick three guys, you stick four guys in a ring, it doesn't feel special. You can have a world title triple threat if you want. Doesn't really matter. The world title's going to open the show anyway. I don't think the WrestleMania main event should be anything but a straight one-on-one singles match. That's just me. So I am not a fan of this whole, let's make it a triple threat with Punk versus Rock versus Cena. I think there's got to be a better way to go. So my thought is you could do one of two things. If CM Punk is a man without a match and Undertaker does not wrestle at WrestleMania, why not go with the WrestleMania 10 scenario where you have two title matches at WrestleMania? I don't care how you do it. You do a coin flip, or you don't even have to do a coin flip. John Cena won the Royal Rumble. That guarantees him a main event at WrestleMania. So John Cena will get the champion, whomever it may be, in the last match on the show. Earlier in the show, you do a WWE Championship match first between Rock and Punk, which I guess would be their third match. And how do you explain that? Well, you know, you can do a screwy finish or a disputed finish of some kind at the Elimination Chamber. Don't just have Rock beat Punk clean again. Have some sort of disputed finish where even if Rock wins, there's a little window there for CM Punk to argue, listen, I got screwed again. I deserve one more shot. And so Punk vs. Rock comes on earlier in the show. The winner of that match defends against Cena in the main event. Okay, that's one scenario that you could go with that I would not necessarily be opposed to. The other option you have, and this one I actually feel like I like more, and this is contingent upon Undertaker being able to wrestle, but not necessarily in a singles match. So either he feels he just can't do a singles match, the company wants to err on the side of caution and doesn't want to put him in a singles match, you do a tag team match. You link Undertaker and Triple H together. You tie this into the whole Lesnar thing, Lesnar beating up Vince McMahon, which probably brings Triple H back into the picture. Lesnar being aligned with Heyman, Punk being aligned with Heyman. There are ways that you can kind of get these two teams to logically come together and book a tag match. Undertaker, Triple H against Brock Lesnar and CM Punk. Now what that does, it gives you something other than a simple rehash of Lesnar versus Triple H, which I thought their match was good, but quite frankly, I didn't think they had a terribly good match. It was good, and that's about as far as I would go with the Lesnar-Triple H match from SummerSlam last year. It's not like they went in there and had a kick-ass match and knocked my socks off. It was good. It wasn't great. I can't say that I'm terribly excited at the prospect of Triple H versus Lesnar 2 at WrestleMania. This would then afford you the opportunity to not have to do Lesnar versus Triple H 2. You can get them in the ring together, but it doesn't have to be a straight singles match. The other thing, it allows Undertaker to appear in a reduced role and advance to 21-0. And in losing, you can plant the seeds of dissension between Punk and Lesnar, because Punk and Lesnar are going to lose that match. And in doing so, like I said, you plant the seeds of dissension. I'm not saying you kind of drive a rift and a wedge right away between them. But by planting those seeds, you open up a plethora of storyline possibilities post-WrestleMania. The problem, of course, is that Brock Lesnar ain't going to be on TV every week. So it's not like you can do this slow build where these guys are together almost with as some sort of faction, perhaps, with Heyman and maybe The Shield. And who knows, maybe eventually Brad Maddox does come back and he ends up being with them. You know, he took his beating and maybe he ends up as part of their little Heyman stable of some kind. Like I said, the problem is Brock is not going to be on TV every week. But you can still do something like that. It opens up just a wide array of possibilities that could eventually lead maybe to a CM Punk face turn or a Brock Lesnar face turn. And the two guys end up pitted against each other. That could be Brock Lesnar's big match that you set up for SummerSlam. And when Brock Lesnar first came back, one of the matches that somebody asked me about that I said personally I was not really all that interested in seeing was CM Punk against Brock Lesnar. To me, the visual of that is just a little too unrealistic. It still is. I mean, let's be honest. If you saw CM Punk and Brock Lesnar together in a ring, in a bar, in any sort of fight, it's just, to me, totally unrealistic to think that CM Punk would stand much of a chance against Brock Lesnar. But at least if there's a storyline reason for it, if they could build something here, you know, Heyman's guys turned against each other, that would pique my interest. I would actually want to see that match. So I like the idea of doing a tag team match. I never thought I'd say that. You know, the one time Undertaker was involved in anything other than a singles match at WrestleMania was WrestleMania 19. It was him in a handicap match against Tenzai, actually, back when he was A-Train and The Big Show. I thought that was a waste of The Undertaker that year. In this case, this could work. This could work, and it wouldn't be the main event, but it would still be a high-profile match for Punk to be in. And would it be a waste of Lesnar's box office to put him in a tag match? I don't think so. I think there would be a lot of intrigue and a lot of interest in that match. So that might just be the way to go. But, you know, who knows? Maybe Undertaker is going to be just fine, and he says, I'm good, let's do the match, me versus Punk, and that's the match they do. If you want my prediction on what's going to happen, I think Undertaker will be ready to go. I think he'll probably be ready to do a singles match. It'll probably be him versus Punk. But if for some reason he can't do it, I think that tag team match would be a better solution.
He's always been a decent wrestler. I would consider him a pretty good wrestler, pretty talented. But great? I don't know. I don't think so. What has he ever done that's great? Like, he's never had a great match, I don't think, ever. I don't know. I don't want to say, but I think Paul's a little overrated. Mm-hmm. He's overrated for being great, but I can't sit here and tell you that I can name one match that I ever thought he ever had with anybody that was great. I don't think he's a great wrestler.
Those comments came from Bret Hart, who spoke with WrestleTalk TV in the UK this past week. Very controversial interview. Obviously did not mince any words about his feelings on Triple H, who of course now is the heir apparent to the throne in WWE, which makes Bret's comments even more suspicious to me, just because Bret is on pretty good terms overall with the company right now. That includes Triple H, Vince. He makes appearances liberally here and there. In fact, Bret made an appearance at the Royal Rumble last weekend. He was already in town for the little fan fest they did. He participated in a panel along with Shawn Michaels that was hosted by Jerry Lawler, talking about what else? Montreal. So because he was in town, they used him the next night at the Rumble. Otherwise, I don't think Bret would have traveled all the way to Phoenix just for a quick backstage cameo with Alberto and Ricardo. That was the reason, really, why he didn't show up on the 20th anniversary of Raw, because he basically said, listen, I am not traveling all the way to Houston for this if you don't have a meaningful role for me, whatever that is. I don't know what that meaningful role would be. Maybe they wouldn't have invited him anyway, but that's the reason why he was at the Rumble, because he was already in town. So this interview here to me is just, you know, you ask yourself, why would he make comments like this? And on the one hand, I kind of respect Bret for it, because obviously he's speaking his mind. And a lot of people in his situation who were on good terms with WWE, and Triple H, of course, is the head guy, right? In some ways, Vince is the head guy, but Triple H is very high on the totem pole. One day he's going to be running the show. In many ways, he already is running the show. And for Bret to go out there and make those kinds of comments takes a lot of brass balls, quite frankly, on his part. It just felt like he didn't care. He was asked a question. He gave an honest answer. He didn't lie. He didn't pussyfoot around it. So for that reason, I respect Bret Hart. And I like Bret Hart. Bret was one of my favorites as I grew up as a wrestling fan. He's one of my favorite champions of all time. In my opinion, one of the best wrestlers of all time. Not the best, but one of the best. He's had some tremendous matches in WWE. Many of my favorite matches involved Bret Hart. The matches with Owen, the matches with Austin, the matches with Shawn. Other matches even here and there with guys like the 1-2-3 Kid and Hakushi and Jerry Lawler and just a whole bunch of other people. Bret was a very good professional wrestler. He took a very realistic beating every time he would have a match, and he would get whipped chest first into the turnbuckle. He would just get the hell beaten out of him, and it would really feel and look like he was taking a beating in there. So I respect Bret for that. Having said that, and I am not the biggest Triple H fan in the world, I think that here's the thing about what Bret said about him being overrated. You heard the comments there. Basically, what Bret said is this. I have a certain amount of respect for Triple H. I think he's overrated. I think he's good. I don't think he's great. And my thought on that is this. When I think of my favorite wrestlers of all time, and this is my own personal list, so I'm biased. I grew up a fan of Hulk Hogan. You know, the whole thing when you grow up in WWF in the mid-80s, the late 80s. So on my list, Hogan would be on the list. Not that Hogan was ever a great wrestler. He was a good wrestler when he wanted to be. Just go watch some of his matches in Japan. He was fine. Hogan would be on the list. Austin would be on the list. Bret would be on the list. Michaels would be on the list. Kurt Angle would be on my list. Okay, there's a lot of names like that would be on my list. Randy Savage, okay, among others. I can't say that Triple H would be on my list of top 10 even. Best wrestlers of all time. I don't think Triple H is a top 10 greatest wrestler of all time. You know, Ric Flair would be on that list. Okay, Triple H would not be on that list. Would Triple H be on my top 20? Perhaps. I'd have to really sit down and take the time to put a list like that together, which I have no interest in doing. For Brett to go and say, though, and by the way, Brett did another interview as well about the subject he was asked, and he made another comment, which you didn't hear in the audio there, about how Triple H wouldn't even be on his list of the top 1,000 greatest wrestlers of all time. Now, to me, I hear these comments, and I hear a lot of bitterness in Brett's voice. Because it's no secret that back in 97, there was a lot of bad blood between Triple H and Brett, mostly from Triple H's side, I think, because Triple H felt like Brett was slighting him in some way. I mean, there's a lot to this backstory here where there was a match on Raw. Brett was supposed to put Triple H over. He had the finish changed. He didn't want to put Triple H over. Whatever the reason was, I guess, you know, he was champion at the time. He didn't feel it was going to be the right thing to do. Triple H wasn't as big back then as he is, you know, now, or even 2 years after that he would become. I think it goes all the way back to that. Everybody knows the story. Triple H on the conference call before Montreal with Shawn and Vince. Triple H is the one who puts forth the idea about doing whatever it takes to get the belt off Brett. Essentially, the Montreal screw job was the brainchild of Triple H. Not Vince McMahon, not Shawn Michaels. And I have not yet read Brett's book. I want to. I have a copy of it. I haven't read it yet. I know he talks about Triple H in the book. From what I understand, the comments are not that complimentary about him. I don't know if he addresses that, if he addresses the fact that he was so intimately involved with the planning or the, again, just the idea even of the screw job being presented. I don't know if he gets into that or not. I think Brett harbors a lot of ill will towards Triple H because of that. I just don't think he likes him. And I think it's coloring some of his comments here because I can understand Brett not wanting to call Triple H a great wrestler. I think, personally, Triple H is a very good wrestler. I think Brett is a little full of himself when he talks about that, and I think he's letting his judgment get clouded by his personal hatred for the man. I don't think he likes Triple H, and I think that's where a lot of this is coming from. I don't really believe that Bret Hart, for example, when he says that Triple H has never had a great match, that's where you lose me. I can rattle off a whole list of great matches Triple H was involved in. You can argue, well, it wasn't him, it was because of his opponent. That's bullshit. When you're in a match, it's either good or it's not, it's great or it's crap, largely because of the effort put forth by both guys. It's not usually just because of one person or the other, unless you're talking about a great Kali match, okay? That's a different story. Triple H has had great matches with Mick Foley, he's had great matches with The Rock, he's had great matches with The Undertaker, he's had great matches with Shawn Michaels, among others. Chris Jericho, okay? He's had a lot of great matches. Triple H, that match with Cactus Jack at the Royal Rumble in 2000, you can't tell me that wasn't a great match. It's one of the best championship matches in certainly Royal Rumble history. I can't remember Bret Hart ever having as good of a championship match at a Royal Rumble as that match was. Not that Bret had that many. He had at least one. Actually, he had two. One of which was with The Undertaker in 96, and I remember that being a boring match. You going to blame that on The Undertaker? You know, and that's the thing about Brett making those comments about the match with Triple H and Undertaker last year. You know, when Brett says, before Triple H wrestled Undertaker last year, I remember watching it and going, I can picture the whole match in my head. I can tell you exactly what this match is going to be, how it's going to go. And I remember watching it, and it went exactly as I predicted. I thought it was mediocre at best, maybe a 4 out of 10 or a 3 out of 10. Okay, so that's what he said about the Triple H Undertaker match last year. Undertaker vs. Triple H last year, to me, was not the match of the year. I think when I did my year-in-review show, I ranked it at number 3, I believe. It was a very good match. I was there for that match. It was a very good match. Was it The Undertaker's best match at WrestleMania? Was it Triple H's best match at WrestleMania? No. But for Brett to sit there and go, well, you know, this match really wasn't that good, and it was only a 3 out of 10... It's one thing if you have some animosity towards Triple H and you want to kind of take it out on him. I hear these comments and I think to myself, what does The Undertaker think hearing these comments? I mean, to me, it's like a slap in the face of The Undertaker every bit as much as it is a slap in the face of Triple H. Are you really want to go out there and hurl insults at The Undertaker? That rubbed me the wrong way when I heard that. But here's what really rubbed me the wrong way. When Brett makes the comment about, oh, I could picture that match in my head move for move before I even watch it. Are you kidding me? You, of all people, are going to make that comment that I could picture the match before I even... Bret Hart would go out there and would have the same fucking match every single week, almost without fail. Sometimes maybe there was some unique stuff mixed in there, and it didn't affect my enjoyment of Bret Hart matches. I love Bret Hart as a wrestler. It was such a pleasure watching him in the ring. But Bret's matches, you know, people complain about John Cena, the five moves of doom. Bret Hart had the five moves of doom before John Cena ever did. Side Russian leg sweep. Elbow smash off the second rope. Backbreaker. I'm getting the order fucked up here, but just work with me here. Sharpshooter. There may have been another move I'm thinking of. Of course, the bump as well in the corner I mentioned when he takes the chest first bump into the corner at warp speed, right? Bret's matches followed the same formula that any other wrestler's matches would follow, just the moves were a little bit different. Bret would go in there, and I too can picture the exact match he was going to have before he would even have it. You could say that about anybody. You could say that about Ric Flair. You can say that about almost all of the top stars. So who is Bret to get, come off saying, well, I could picture that match before it even happened, and that's why I thought the match was only mediocre at best, as though Bret would go out there every week and would bust out a brand new move. I never saw Bret Hart bust out a plancha in a match. I never saw Bret Hart bust out a Hurricane Rana. He'd throw a victory roll in there every now and then. That's how he won the King of the Ring in 93. But, I mean, give me a break. It's the same criticism that he levied against Ric Flair, another person that he hates. Bret has had a war of words before with Ric Flair. They've gone back and forth, and I think it stems from comments that Ric made in his book about Bret that Bret was probably irked by. So Bret decided to take it upon himself to go around saying Ric Flair sucked and this and that, although, in fairness, Bret's been saying that for a lot longer. Bret was making comments about Ric Flair even in the early 90s. And when they worked together in WWF, they had some pretty good matches, and I remember hearing that, you know, Bret reamed Flair out in the locker room once before a match in 93. I think it was before a house show. They went out there and had an hour-long Iron Man match, basically, in Boston. And as the story goes, Bret was in the locker room and basically was, you know, yelling at Flair about something and telling him, I'm going to be the ring general tonight. And anyway, the point is, he said the same thing about Flair in the past. Flair's matches were all the same. The big Flair flop, right? And the Flair flip in the corner, throw him off the top rope. And that's true. Ric Flair's matches were very much the same way. There's a reason why people will say that Ric Flair is one of, if not the greatest wrestler of all time. It doesn't change the fact that he would go out there and have great matches. So to hear Bret say that, I thought it's like the pot calling the kettle black. I mean, really, that, of all the things for him to say, that was a pretty weak argument of all people for Bret Hart to use when your fucking matches would be very similar also every time you would go out there. So to me, that's a completely invalid argument. So, yeah, again, I don't know what side of the bed he woke up on that day or what Triple H may have said to him in Phoenix, maybe. Maybe Triple H spilled coffee on him or something and put Bret in a bad mood. But I think he's letting his personal feelings get in the way of his, perhaps his honest feelings. I don't know what his real thoughts are on the Triple H Undertaker match. Maybe that's how he really feels. You can be a great wrestler. You can be great at whatever you do, whether you're a wrestler or not. I could think that I'm very good at my day job. The difference is, people don't want to hear you going around talking about how great you are. And that's one of the things that has always irked me about Bret. And it's one of the things that some other wrestlers will complain about, members of the clique who were no innocent angels. But whether it was Kevin Nash or Triple H himself would make comments in interviews in the past to the effect of Bret had a very high opinion of himself. And I think you listen to that interview and you hear it there. Bret has always had a very high opinion of himself. He'll always stick comment, well, you know, I was the best at this, you know. You know, back in the day when I would do this, I would do it in such a way that made me, you know, different from everybody else. And, you know, I don't want to toot my own horn or, you know, he always has a way of kind of sneaking little comments in there because he really in his mind feels that he was among the best and one of the greats of all time. And he was, but nobody wants to hear you say that. You can be great and let other people do the talking for you. Let people like me, when I do shows like this, talk about what a great wrestler Bret Hart was. But when Bret Hart goes out there and talks about what a great wrestler Bret Hart was, you could see where that will rub people the wrong way. And I think that's a very valid criticism of Bret, quite frankly. If we're going to throw it back in his face here, I think that that's a very valid criticism. And why things don't necessarily sit well with people when Bret makes comments like this, because, you know, for Bret to say, you know, well, you know, I was an innovator, just like people like CM Punk and Rey Mysterio were innovators. Well, that's true. Rey Mysterio certainly was an innovator. I don't know if you can call CM Punk an innovator. I think Kenta over in Japan might have something to say about that, given that Punk has stolen some of his moves. But I see the point he's trying to make. people don't want to hear you talk about how great you are. I think that that's a lesson that Brett still hasn't learned after all these years. And like I said, I am not the biggest Triple H fan in the world. I do think in some ways he is a little bit overrated, perhaps. But I think he's still a very good wrestler. And this notion that he's never had a great match, and Brett says, God, you think he'd have a great match by now? I don't know what Brett's been watching over the last 10, 12 years. I could think of a whole bunch of great matches that Triple H has had. And, you know, he'll go into the Hall of Fame one day, and rightfully so. And people are always going to say whatever they want to say about him and Stephanie. And would he be as successful if he didn't marry the boss's daughter? I don't think he would have been as successful. Obviously, he wouldn't run the fucking company. But I still think he would have done very well for himself because he's very good. Now, there's a reason WCW signed him. WCW wanted to re-sign him to a contract. There was a bidding war of sorts between WCW and WWF back in 94, 95 for Triple H's services. Triple H went to the WWF, and the rest is history. But he was a sought-after commodity because he was a good wrestler. People had a lot of high hopes for him when he was younger. So, anyway, that's my thoughts on the Bret Hart situation there. I think Bret's a little full of himself. I love Bret Hart. I think he's, you know, one of the best of all time, but he's delusional if he thinks Triple H is the only guy to have a match where you can predict the moves he was going to use in the match before it even happened. Like I said, it's a little hypocritical, I think, of him to say that. One final WWE news note here. El Generico passed all of his physicals. He has signed his contract, so he is officially a member of the WWE roster. So congratulations to him. He is due to report to NXT sometime this month, and the belief is that they will have him wrestling without a mask, but I guess we shall see on that one. Let's shift over to TNA here, because there was some pretty big Impact Wrestling news this week. TNA announced that it will begin filming all Impact TV shows on the road permanently as part of their 2013 television programming strategy. First live televised show will be March 14th from the Sears Center in Chicago. The idea, apparently, is to tape every other week on Thursdays. So, for example, they would tape, let's say, a live show. They would tape two shows that night, one of which would then air. The tape show would air the following week, and then they'd be back live the week after. I think that's the schedule they're looking at here. Not unlike what WWF used to do with the Raw tapings back in the day, although back then they would have one live Raw the night after a pay-per-view, and the next 3 weeks would all be taped shows. This sounds like you'll have one live show and then one tape show, and they'll go off and on like that. And I think that's fine. I think it's a fantastic idea. It's one of those things that I think was really holding TNA back, was having that show in the Impact Zone every week. And they're making a move here that I think is going to be a positive move for their future. You know, they've been taping Impact in the Impact Zone for the past 8 years. And at some point, you know, you only fit 900 people or 1,000 people in there, and it's the same building, it's the same setting, week after week after week. In a lot of cases, the same fans, who probably get a little tired of seeing the show every single week, and you got to get out of there. And so apparently the final two shows at the Impact Zone are going to be February 28th and March 7th. That will be the final, perhaps final ever, Impact tapings from the Impact Zone. I think eventually they'll be back. Hopefully not, like, permanently, but I think at some point we'll see more tapings from the Impact Zone, maybe next year, perhaps. But, like I said, I mean, the last time they were in the Sears Center in Chicago, which is where they're going to be on the 14th, was for Bound for Glory back in 2008, which at the time set the highest TNA attendance record in this country. And I went back and checked, and they had about 5,000 people for that pay-per-view. If they can pack in even a little less than that for most of these shows going forward, it'll change the whole dynamic of the show. I mean, it'll just make it feel that much more major league. I'm real bullish on this move. I like it a lot. It's been a long time coming. But to me, before they make this change, I'd like to see them do something else first, like apologize to their UK fans who bought tickets to those Impact tapings, believing that Jeff Hardy would be there because TNA advertised him, knowing full well he wouldn't be there. It was a sleazy move on their part. They need to own up to it. I talked about it last week. I'm not going to let this go. You know, it's just, neither should those fans. Hopefully those fans are writing in as well. Hopefully they're pissed, as pissed as I am just hearing about it. I just think it was a real sleazy, scummy move on their part. There was no mention of it, of course. On television, it's all about the injury angle. Jeff Hardy got his knee bashed in by aces and eights, and so now they're teasing that next week on Impact, they'll have an MRI update. Reason being, Hardy couldn't fly to the UK, and they taped four shows there, so he's not going to be able to appear on any of them, which means he may only have one live appearance before lockdown. Something tells me TNA isn't going to be doing that anytime soon. As far as Impact this past week, I liked the show. I thought it was a pretty good show. They were in the UK. It really looked Major League. If this is a sign of things to come, I think it's a really big plus for TNA. I don't know how many people were there. Obviously more than you would get in the Impact Zone, but the way they filmed it, the way they packed them in, it looked like it could have been a WWE show. You know, maybe not 15,000 people, but it felt Major League. And for that reason, it gave the show a very special feel. Some of the things on the show, actually opened up with the Bad Influence promo, but the first match was Magnus, who made his big return on this show last time we saw him. He had been attacked viciously by the Aces and Eights. Magnus in his home country got a great ovation, looked like a complete star. Just he came off as such a big star here, and I think one day he will be. But it was him against D-Von. He called out D-Von of Aces and Eights to try to gain revenge for their attack on him, and he beat D-Von. He actually beat D-Von by disqualification. So keep that in mind, because that was the first of two Aces and Eights matches on the show, and they lost. And I've said before, Aces and Eights is a bunch of losers. They lose every single match they're in. This is not an exaggeration. They had two matches on this show, and they lost this one. And the second one, we'll get to that a little bit later. Some other stuff on this show. Joe Park had a match, his first Impact, official match on Impact. It was open fight night. He was going to call somebody out. Robbie E came out along with Robbie T, so there was a match between Joe Park and Robbie E. And I love Joe Park. I shout that from the highest rooftop. He is my favorite character in all of wrestling. When he gets beaten up, when somebody kicks him in the gut, bullies him around a little bit, I actually feel sympathy for the character. I am totally invested in this character. And I was very disappointed when they came to his segment, they completely skipped over his entrance. We didn't get to hear his music. However, when he won, and he did win, they played his L.A. Law knockoff theme, which just is excellent. I just think it fits the character so well. So the Joe Park stuff, I think, is great. Keep it up. Keep doing it. Very entertained by it. For whatever this is worth, I thought Brooke Hogan was actually looking pretty good on the show. Shoot me, but that's just how I felt. Here's something very bizarre that they did on this show. They had Hulk Hogan, Sting, Bully Ray, Brooke Hogan out there for a segment, and Hulk Hogan overturned Bully's suspension. So Bully Ray is no longer suspended. He is back. And Hogan gave him a hearty handshake as Hogan was leaving the arena later on with Brooke. The TMZ guy stopped him to interview him, and Hogan was saying, listen, basically Hogan found religion. All of a sudden, he's changed his mind on Bully Ray. And that's great, but to me, it just came out of left field, because for weeks, all we heard from Hogan, I don't trust you. You're not good enough for my daughter. I don't trust you. Something doesn't pass the smell test here. And they did the wedding, and even after the wedding, it was like Hogan still wasn't exactly, he hadn't come around yet on Bully Ray. And in 1 week, it's like, boom, all of a sudden Hogan is, you're reinstated, he's shaking his hand. I just felt like I must have missed a part of this chapter here. I'm not sure if there was a segment that aired somewhere that I missed. This just kind of came out of nowhere. So we have the main event. Main event was a steel cage match between Kurt Angle and Mr. Anderson. And pretty good match, especially for a Mr. Anderson match. This is where they pulled off the big turn with Wes Briscoe and Garrett Bischoff, which has been coming for months now, many months. They perhaps waited a little longer than they should have to pull the trigger on this, but they pulled the trigger finally. They didn't try to swerve us by not having them turn and having Kurt turn on them and join Aces and Eights or some stupid shit that Vince Russo would have probably booked. This was, you know, predictable, but it was effective, I thought. And I was debating with somebody on Facebook who said, oh, you know, Impact, you know, Briscoe and Bischoff turn, it was so predictable. And as I argued to him, just because stuff is predictable doesn't mean it's bad. You know, just because stuff is predictable doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. Sometimes that may be true, but in a case like this, I'm happy they stuck to their guns. Because they've been teasing it for so long that for them to not deliver would have been a huge disappointment, I think. So they delivered on the turn. It wasn't exactly, you know, Dusty in the cage back in 86 or whatever with the Horsemen. But still, they attacked Kurt. And by the way, Kurt beat Mr. Anderson, which is what I was getting at earlier. So Aces and Eights lose not one, but two matches on the show because they are losers. They got back some of their heat. Briscoe and Bischoff turned on Kurt. They beat him up at the end of the show and have officially joined Aces and Eights. So that turn has finally happened. And I mentioned this on Twitter. You know, I love Kurt Angle, but my biggest pet peeve with him and his matches is the way he waits until it's too late to kick out from a near fall. Has anybody else ever noticed this? You know, he'll be pinned, his shoulders are down, one, two, and, you know, I know what he's trying to do. He's trying to get his shoulder up and kick out just before the ref counts three. But what ends up happening, and this happens all the time with Kurt, he waits so long that the ref almost has to hold up his count, and it looks so phony. And then finally, Kurt gets his shoulder up. And probably the worst example of this I've ever seen that I can remember was ironically one of the greatest WrestleMania matches of all time, which was him against Shawn Michaels back at WrestleMania 21. There's a great spot in that match where Kurt is just yelling at Shawn, telling him to stay down, stay down. He kind of brings him to his feet. And then Shawn all of a sudden just pushes Kurt away and just kicks him square right in the face. Like one of the best super kicks you'll ever see. Just right on the jaw. And after Kurt eats the super kick, Michaels covers him for the pin. And Kurt almost like forgot to lift his shoulder up. So the referee literally held the count up. He counted 3.5, basically, before Kurt finally kicked out. Even the crowd kind of groaned. Like, come on, you know, give me a break. And Kurt does this in almost every single match. And there's very little you can criticize about a Kurt Angle match. And believe me, I'm not one to sit here and criticize Kurt Angle. I mean, but that's just one little pet peeve that annoys me. And that happened in this match as well. But as far as the angle after the match, I thought it was good. I am no fan of Aces and Eights, but God, they've been teasing this for so long now that I'm glad they finally delivered. It's over, it's done, and we can move on to the next chapter of this rivalry, which I guess we'll find out. I haven't read far in advance. I haven't read any, really, of the taping spoilers for the next 3 weeks of Impact, so I'd rather watch it myself. I'm sure that we probably are going to find out very soon what the main event of Lockdown is going to be. I would imagine it's some TNA versus Aces and Eights kind of tag match. With Kurt, maybe Sting and Bully and some other people against the Aces and Eights. We'll see where they end up going with that. I was going to do a review this week, a quick review of the Nigel McGuinness documentary, The Last of McGuinness. I had a chance to watch it about a day or two ago. I finished it, and I'm running out of time here. I have a lot of feedback to get to, so what we'll do is next week on episode 259, I'll talk about that documentary, have some thoughts on the Last of McGuinness next week. But right now, let's go into the mailbag, your questions and shout-outs. You can always email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com, thesolomonster@gmail.com. This one comes from Ash from Melbourne, Australia. In 2011, I asked for something nobody had ever asked for on your show before, and that was a shout-out for my birthday. Now it's a regular thing, and listeners can be part of your show that way and request shout-outs for anyone and everyone. In 2012, I once again wrote in and got a shout-out for my birthday, and jokingly said that you need to create a segment to fit all the shout-outs in, which you decided to do. So, in 2013, I am once again asking for a shout-out for my 20th birthday coming up on February 5th. So, happy birthday, Ash. He is an innovator, I guess. This guy is a pioneer, you might say. His question is, while watching SmackDown this past week, I realized the great Khali is in the SmackDown chamber. WWE always decides to put him in the chamber match as a spot filler, as everyone knows he's not going to win, and he's not really much of a threat, when the space could go to somebody more deserving, like an upcoming superstar on the roster that could be a dark horse in the match, or if they want to stick with the former world champion's theme, somebody like Rey Mysterio. Well, Rey Mysterio is dealing with some personal issues right now. I think some family stuff. I'm not even sure he's really back on TV full-time. He was on SmackDown this week because they were in San Diego. Beyond that, who knows? But I agree with you. I think Khali is a waste of space in that match. I as I said earlier, if you're going to go with Mark Henry or Christian, I just think somebody like that would be a much better choice. But if you're not, then you know what? He may not be a former world champion, but I wouldn't mind seeing somebody like Bo Dallas win a fluky match to get into the chamber. I mean, I know he's doing his thing with Wade Barrett right now, but so what? I mean, you know, it's a way to get him in a situation where he could really have a good showing. He's not going to win. I mean, he stands about as much of a chance of winning as Khali does, but the point is, what are you really gaining by having Khali in there? But if you put Bo Dallas or somebody like that in there, what's the worst that happens? They're the first one eliminated. They're in there for 2 minutes. It's a waste. But at best, maybe they last for a little while. Maybe they you know, get some offense on some of the big stars and people go nuts for him, and then he finally gets eliminated. At least you've given him a chance to get himself over. I remember a couple years ago they had Drew McIntyre, who by this point was already in the midst of being de-pushed for whatever the reason was. And, you know, McIntyre made his way into the SmackDown Chamber match. This would have been about probably, I don't know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And he had his own spot in that match where once he got out of the pod, he went crazy. He was beating people up. He was throwing people through the glass. Even the announcers were like, look at Drew McIntyre. Holy shit, this guy's on a tear. He's a house of fire in there. And unfortunately, they never really went anywhere with it. It was just kind of a one-time thing. But the point is, it's a chance for somebody to stand out. And I agree, Kali in that situation is a complete waste. But you know what? Wasn't it SummerSlam? It was Team WWE against the Nexus, where Kali was supposed to be in that match, and he got taken out by Nexus like a week or two before, and they replaced him on the team. You know, maybe the Shield can take out Kali or before the pay-per-view or something. It's still possible he may not make it into the chamber. Kenneth writes in, I understand the logic of having a feud and having the first match being a straight singles match, then a few more, and then culminating in a gimmick to end the feud. But why does it have to be that way? If you had a gimmick match last, that leaves the feud to end in a screwy way. Someone runs in, someone cheats. If things culminate in a straight singles match, it puts the two superstars in a situation to see who is the better man. This way, maybe there is a clean finish and someone gets over. I know you can't do this every single time, but you seem to bash this every time it occurs. I bash it because it's fucking stupid, that's why. It's ass backwards. Why does it have to be that way? It doesn't have to be that way, but it is that way for a reason. Because it makes sense. I don't understand your logic, you know, that if you have a gimmick match last, it's always going to have a screwy finish. I mean, some of them will. But the whole point of having a steel cage match to blow off a feud or Hell in a Cell or no DQ or whatever is to prevent outside interference or to avoid having the chicken shit heel try to get himself DQ'd or get himself counted out. It's intended to work in the exact opposite way that you describe. You know, there's a much likelier possibility of somebody running into a match if it's a straight singles match. And the other, the more important reason it's done this way is because it's just good business. You build to a gimmick that people will want to pay to see. You don't start a feud between two guys and just put them in a Hell in a Cell match in their first match. You know, there has to be a reason for the gimmick. I mean, I don't mean to get hot at you. I mean, Kenneth asked some pretty great questions, but you want to know why I would always ridicule Vince Russo for this? I assume that's what you're getting at when you mention that I bash it, because I always... Usually I mention this in the context of Vince Russo, who became popular to the point of hilarity in TNA, because that's always how he would book these things. In TNA, he would book the cage match first or something and then build to a straight singles match. There's a reason Vince Russo was no longer working in wrestling. Let's put it like that. So that's the most honest answer I can give you. It's done that way for a reason. It's been done that way for decades because it works. Blackleg from the Philippines. Many moons ago, I was blessed to get a shout-out from you for two of the most important people in my life. Now, I hope you can do the same for me. My birthday is on February 4th, and I would really appreciate an elusive shout-out as a gift. So, happy birthday, Blackleg. He's been writing me since, God, I think April of 2011. I looked it up before. I have emails from him going back as far as almost 2 years ago. And I know he's been listening for a lot longer than that. So, I appreciate his support. He has a question as well. How do you think WWE will freshen up the second Rock vs. Cena match? How will they change the face-versus-face dynamic? Will they insert Punk? I just hope the story this time will be good enough so that we won't have to be subjected to history lessons, rap battles, rock concerts, and corny bleacher monologues. Well, they're not turning either guy, so face-versus-face isn't going to change. People already, you know, look at John Cena as the heel anyway. Unless you insert Punk in the equation, it's going to be rap battles and some corny comedy. I mean, I half expect them to team the two of them up and have them win the tag belts from Kane and Bryan just so they could fulfill their love of, you know, pairing off opponents to win the titles, which they've done a million times before. I don't know what they're going to do. You know, half the fun, I think, is waiting to find out. Ryan from California, I've been a weekly listener since SoundUp 175 when I almost literally died laughing at your response to the question, what does Rey Mysterio say when he headbutts children? Anyway, I have one question for you relating to the Shield. It seems to me that out of the three members of the Shield, that Seth Rollins is the one that does not belong. Dean Ambrose is the obvious talker and face of the group, while I have been extremely impressed with Roman Reigns, as he brings that fire, intensity, and aggression that makes the group look legitimately scary, while Rollins just seems to kind of be there. He doesn't really add anything, and his promos need work. I almost believe that Cassius Ohno should have taken his spot instead of taking Reigns' spot, like many people said when the group first appeared. Well, I was one of those people who said that, and I'm happy to admit that I was wrong. I like Roman Reigns. I agree 100%. He brings a fire and an intensity to that group that would really be lacking if he wasn't there. And I really think he could be the first big breakout star from the Shield when they eventually break up. More because he's big, and that's what WWE likes. He's got a good look. I see where you're coming from on Rollins, and yes, his promo work has never been regarded as anything great. Even in Ring of Honor, he was pretty bad when it came to that kind of stuff. But he's a great worker. I mean, I've seen him many times before. He takes great bumps. You know, TLC was a good example of that. He was a maniac for even agreeing to do that. You know, he may not have the wackiness of Dean Ambrose or the fire that Roman Reigns has, but I look at him as kind of the anchor of the group in a lot of ways, and we really haven't had a chance yet to see what he has to offer. I mean, you could say that about all three of them, really. They're only scratching the surface with the Shield. We haven't really seen them do much. At some point, they'll start having tag matches, they'll start having singles matches, and we'll get to learn a little bit more. They'll start to peel back those layers, especially Dean Ambrose. I feel like Dean Ambrose, you start peeling back layers of his character, it's probably going to be frightening, quite frankly, to see. And I can't wait for it. Richard Sanders from Bowling Green, Ohio. I've been a listener of the Sound Off since episode 70 and was wondering if I could get a shout out. I'm currently studying abroad this semester in Aberystwyth, Wales. And listening to your podcast reminds me of home a lot. I greatly appreciate the work you do. My question is regarding the cancellation of the Intercontinental Cup, because WWE wanted Wade Barrett to feud with Bo Dallas right now. Do you think it would have been better to have Bo win the tournament to face Barrett? I feel that it would have given him some credibility going into this feud. Only if he would have been booked against lower-level guys to get to Barrett. You know, the way they booked him on Raw, being all shocked and surprised that he actually won a match. You know, the whole G-golly, I won a match gimmick, if you put him in there with guys like Kofi and Cody and Sandow or whoever, and Bo Dallas beats them all, what does that say about those guys? You know, they all just come off like a bunch of goobers, I think, if you do that. But if you put him in there with, like, Tenzai or Darren Young, guys like that who he could beat and it doesn't matter, then I'm fine with that. But I would prefer they don't go and announce shit without having already figured out what their plans are for, you know, 1 week in advance. You want to do something with Bo Dallas and Wade Barrett to help get the kid over, that's great. I'm fine with that, but if you announce a tournament to determine the number one contender for the title and then don't build a feud with Bo Dallas right now. It's very simple. Just deliver what you promised. That's what I wish they would do. Alvin had an interesting thought. If it was Undertaker who won at Bad Blood in 1997, how do you think the Montreal Screwjob would have went? It is probably one of those inevitable instances that would have occurred regardless of Bret's opponent. I don't believe for a second that Undertaker would have double-crossed Bret Hart. Not for 1 second. If it was Undertaker versus Bret at Survivor Series and Vince McMahon clued Undertaker in about their plans to screw Bret out of the title, I truly don't believe that Undertaker would have gone along with it. Or at the very least, he would have clued Bret in about what they were planning to do, kind of give him a heads up on that. He had too much respect for Bret to do that to him. Undertaker was the one guy who was actually, he was backstage at the pay-per-view in Montreal. Even though he didn't actually wrestle on the card. He had no match at Survivor Series, but he was there. He was banging on Vince McMahon's door when Vince locked himself in his dressing room, telling Vince he had to go to Bret's locker room and apologize for what he did to him. So there's no way. There's no way he would have done that. There's no way he would have gone along with it the way that Shawn Michaels did. There's just no way. Same goes for some of the other veterans on the roster at the time, like Mankind, Vader, Steve Austin. I don't believe any of them would have done that. And it really says a lot about Shawn Michaels and Triple H back then, doesn't it? About the kind of people they were. You know, it's as though if Shawn Michaels had refused to go along with the screw job, Vince would have actually fired him. Sure. I mean, if you believe that, then there's a bridge here in Brooklyn I can sell you. It's just complete horse shit. And like I said, I don't believe for a second the Undertaker would have gone along with it. So what would have happened? Who the hell knows? I mean, that probably would have been entertaining as hell to watch if Brett went out there knowing they were going to screw him. That would have been very interesting. Omar from Australia. I've been a listener since about episode 190 and was instantly hooked. I've not missed a single episode of the Sound Off since. I look forward to listening to your thoughts each week. And thank you for your hard work. I heard that Undertaker's opponent this year at WrestleMania was most likely going to be CM Punk, with reports of Undertaker not being physically able to compete, possibly. Where would this leave Punk, keeping in mind he is coming off the heels of the longest WWE Championship reign of the modern era? Is there anyone, apart from Stone Cold, who can realistically give Punk the high-profile WrestleMania match he deserves? Just seems rather foolish to me that you would spend all this time building this guy up, giving him such a long title run and back-to-back main event pay-per-view matches against The Rock, only to have him potentially lost in the shuffle on this year's WrestleMania card. Also, do you ever see Punk headlining a WrestleMania before he retires? I do. I do think he'll headline. If not this year, I think his best shot is a match with Steve Austin. And I think it either happens next year or it doesn't happen at all. I think if it's not Punk vs. Austin at WrestleMania 30, that match never happens. The only other way you get a real high-profile mainstream match involving CM Punk is, you know, probably to go the celebrity route and maybe try to rekindle some of that heat he had before with Chris Brown. Remember he had that Twitter beef with Chris Brown a while back? Chris Brown was back in the news again recently. He got into an altercation with Frank Ocean. You know, that would certainly get people talking about the show if you can build something with Punk and him. The problem with that is Chris Brown is a piece of shit. And I have no interest in seeing him at WrestleMania or him getting a big fat paycheck just to show up and have a bad match. So, to answer your question, unless they do make a triple threat with him and Rock and Cena this year, I think his best bet's going to be a match with Austin next year. If it doesn't happen then, I don't think it ever happens. That's going to do it for the mailbag this week. Thank you all for your feedback. Got a lot of it. Couldn't even get to all of it, but I still want more questions. I responded last night to a whole bunch of people directly. Who I've been neglecting. So email me your questions, your comments, shout-outs, thesolemonster@gmail.com. That's where everything should go. Please email me. Don't do Facebook as much, especially if you want something on the show. Email is the way to go. Follow me on Twitter, @solemonster, and friend me on Facebook as well, facebook.com/thesolemonster. That's the official profile page for yours truly and the show. And you can also subscribe to the show for free in iTunes. Type in Solemonster Sounds Off. And whenever a new show is uploaded, it will be automatically downloaded to your computer, your mobile device, whatever you want. It will be there waiting for you. Also, I am a contributor, for those of you who still don't know, to the LayfieldReport.com. LayfieldReport.com is JBL's official website. My latest column was supposed to go up this weekend, didn't happen. I got a little sidetracked, so I'm hoping at some point this week that next column will be up, and I will, of course, update all of you on Twitter and Facebook when it does go up, and again, your support with that is always appreciated, so whenever a new column goes up, if you want to tweet JBL @JCLayfield and let them know what you think about it, that would certainly be very much appreciated, but you can check out my work there as well. So that's going to do it for episode 258 this week. Super Sound Off 258. Enjoy the Super Bowl. Like I said, San Francisco all the way. That's my pick. What did I say, 28-20? Probably be something like that. We'll have that review of the Nigel McGuinness documentary next week and a whole lot more. So until then, be well, stay safe, and we'll see you right back here next week, as always, on SEScoops.com.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solemonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.